Welcome to DragonCon. I'm Stephen Grenade. I will be talking about D-Wave 1 and quantum computing today. How many of you are familiar with quantum computing? Have a quantum computer? If so, I'd like to talk to you. So, May 11, 2011, D-Wave 1. The company D-Wave says, we have a 128-qubit quantum computer that we are selling. And in fact, as the first commercially available quantum computer is also the first commercially sold quantum computer. Lockheed Martin actually went and... I'm sorry, I'm hearing voices. Anyone else hearing voices? Please say yes. Okay, good. I was worried. So, okay. Well, I have the table here between us. I might be okay. So, Lockheed Martin bought one. And as you can imagine, the internet news sites got really interested in this. So there, I mean, all across the internet, there were all these stories about D-Wave 1 and the quantum computer. And as you can imagine, on all of the internet boards, people got really interested in this and discussed it in interesting ways. Cryptography so that everyone would be able to decrypt PGP and not just the government, since evidently the government already has their quantum computer. Superpower computer that goes beyond anything possible with classical computers, defense company that makes missiles and stuff. I guess we do the math here. And then my particularly favorite one, the fact that they use Python makes them question it, because if it's a quantum computer, it shouldn't be logically compatible with any of the programming languages, even at a high level. So, needless to say, this is not necessarily right. I see some bronies are out here. So, you know, as people talked about it on the internet, it got more and more heated and more things. And so they're like, all right, encryption is broken because of this quantum computer. We're doomed. We're doomed. We're doomed. That is not necessarily true. They're saying we're doomed. The financial system is going to blow up. We're all dead. Also not really true. So really the question is, what is D-Wave 1? Why do people get so excited about the idea of a commercially available quantum computer? You know, why are quantum computers of interest anyway? We've already got computers. What do we need, you know, quantum computers? And so, you know, are we going to be screwed by it? And the answer is no. So if any of you need to get to another panel, you now have the punchline of the talk and can head out. But for the rest of you, what I want to do is talk about quantum computers and sort of go through some of the foundational ideas behind quantum computing and why it is of interest to people, and then talk specifically about the kind of quantum computer that D-Wave has made and is selling, because it turns out not all quantum computers are equal. They're doing a different class of quantum computers than what a lot of other people sort of think of when you think, I guess I should say, classical quantum computing. So, a lot of you know about quantum computers, and that sounds great. So, you know, if you want to come up and give my talk, actually, I could catch up on sleep. I stayed up a little late last night, which is never a good idea. I already have Monday morning voice on Friday, so yay con. All right, so let's talk about quantum computing. This is not quantum computing. There are a lot of misconceptions about it that I want to go through. So, the other thing I need to tell you is I'm going to lie to you, but it's for your own good. There's a lot of this stuff that if you go into it, you can go down a rabbit hole of physics and it gets very deep very fast. So I'm going to be describing it using a lot of analogies and hand wavings and things like that. So if this gets you interested in quantum computing and interested in the theories behind it, I really encourage you. There are a lot of good websites out there that will lead you into the deeper theory. I'm just going to try to give you a flavor and a general idea of what it's at. So see, it's the good kind of lying. It's science lying. All right, so let's talk about classical computers. We'll start with there and then move into the quantum computers. Classical computers work with bits. So, you know, we're going all the way back to old school. We're before assembly. We're at punch card level. Bits. Ones and zeros. And, you know, it's a binary representation of a decimal number. So here I have 10011. Well, so you have... give my talk. He's already adding them. So the thing is, you know, if you think about a normal numbering system, it's one, and then tens, and then a hundreds, and a thousand, you know, just like you learned in kindergarten. Here it's ones, twos, four, eight, 16, 32, 64, and all like that. So this is, in fact, 19 for those of you who read ahead. Classical computers shove these bits around, and there's a limit to how fast you can do that. You know, the computers, as we know, have been getting better and better, but there's always, you know, the new version of Microsoft Word that's going to make everything even slower. And what we have been depending on for computers to get faster is we sort of have this mystical idea of something that Mr. Moore from Intel said. Y'all heard of Moore's Law? So Gordon Moore was a co-founder of Intel, and back in the day he said the number of transistors that we can put on a computer chip doubles roughly every 18 months. And that tends to correspond to roughly a doubling of speed and a lot of other things like that. And it's a law that is pretty much held true. Here are Intel's processors, you know, back from 1970, so the 4004, 8008, all that, up to the new Pentiums and Core 2 Duos and all that. And this is the number of transistors on each of those chips, plotted on a log scale. So if it's doubling every couple of months, that's an exponential growth. On a log line, you get a straight line. So indeed, Moore's law has been holding true, more or less. But that will not go on forever. You start running into problems with things like the way that we make chips is with photolithography, and the way that they've been cramming these transistors more and more on there is to go to finer and finer scale photolithography. You know, they're doing all kinds of tricks with lasers and things like that to get to a finer and finer scale. That can only go on so long. The other problem is, as you make them smaller and smaller and you pack them together, eventually you will get to the point where quantum effects start to be a problem, and in fact not the kind of quantum effects that we want from a quantum computer. You'll have electrons tunneling from one to another and just playing hob and messing all that kind of stuff up. So the other trick that we tend to do is stack computers together. You know, you've got the dual core, the quad core, you just keep jamming processors on top of that. Sorry, Monday voice. But the problem with doing that is, in physics speak, it scales linearly. So if I want twice the computing power, I need twice the chips. If I want four times the computing power, I need four times the chip. If I want 1,000 times, I need 1,000 chips. And that means that you're going to increase the space you need, physical space. You increase the power, all of that kind of thing. So you don't really get, you know, doubling is nice, but if we could get exponential, that would be even better. That's not what we get when we stack processors together. And a fairly smart guy by the name of Richard Feynman got really interested in this back in the 1980s. And one of the things that he pointed out is, as a physicist, there were a lot of problems that he was interested in, especially in terms of quantum mechanics. And he's like, modeling quantum mechanics on a computer takes a whole lot of resources. There are a lot of really hard physical problems to model, but nature does it all the time. You know, all these quantum processes happen in nature. Could you come up with some way to harness that and use that for your computing? Can you compute with quantum? So let's talk about quantum effects and how we use that for computation. Lights and polarizers. This is always all physics things start out either with lights and polarizers or, you know, blocks stacked up and sliding on each other. That's all physics education. Now you have a PhD. Congratulations. So, if you take light, normally coming out from things like this, from the light, it's incoherent. So it's going, the EM waves are going in all sorts of different directions as it propagates out. And if you put in a polarizer in the way, what it does is it knocks out everything except the light that is, roughly speaking, vibrating in one direction. Again, slight lie, look it up on the internet, I can tell you more. So if you can imagine taking one polarizer that only lets light that goes this way, and then put another polarizer that goes this way in front of, stack them together, and all of a sudden you get no light. Because, you know, it wiggles this way and then hits the next polarizer and it doesn't go through. Here shown, you know, like little grates. But something odd happens if you put another polarizer in at 45 degrees. So you get light that goes this way, and then all of a sudden you get light that goes that way, and then you get light that goes that way, and it passes through. It's like it's rotating it. So let's talk about why that happens. Now, you'll notice I've got little sort of bracket notations over there. That is essentially the signal to you that I'm talking about something quantum. When I talk about something quantum, I put this in this little basis state. So light goes this way, and I get vertical light. If it goes through that polarizer, I get a little horizontal light. But when I throw a 45-degree polarizer in there, what ends up is I have a mix, in effect. It's at 45 degrees, so it's a little up and down. It's a little left and right. And so what that means is the little bit of left and right can then go through that polarizer. And the reason that I wanted to do this is to point out a couple of things. First of all, this is what's called a basis set. So you can take a system and put it into mutually orthogonal states that don't mix. So in this case, up and down and left and right. And you can create a superposition of these states. So in this case, the superposition is a little bit up and down and a little bit left and right. And the numbers in front of there give you, if you square them, the probability that you're in the state. Because remember, and when we talk about quantum, we're talking about probabilities. We're talking about the chance that if you observe it, it will be in there. So let's talk about it in terms of observation. When I pass it through the polarizer, I observe that it's up and down. If I pass it through this polarizer, I observe that it's left and right. When I put that 45-degree polarizer in there, I've got it in a mix, and I don't know for any individual photon if it's going to be, in essence, an up and down an up and down photon or a left and right photon until it goes through and I observe it with this left and right polarizer. So the reason that this is important is because this right here, that's our bit. A bit is one and zero, on, off. I just need two things that are mutually exclusive, and that can be my bit. I can do it with light in this case by having up, down in one case, left, right in another. I can do it with spins of an electron. I just need something that I can say, one of these is one and one of these is zero. One of these is zero. All right, so what happens if you build up a computer? Oh, I forgot that was in there. Sorry, that was me talking through the part where I observe. So just take all those words I said before and put them on this slide and we'll be good. Qubits. So what does that mean? Some of y'all played qubit. That's awesome. So qubits. Also not qubits. Whatever. You can make a qubit out of anything that is mutually exclusive and you got two states. So like with the light, up, down, and left, right. So what does that get us? Well, remember how I said if you've got two states, so in this case, again, up, down, left, right, I can put it in a superposition where it's a little bit up, down, a little bit left, right. Well, imagine that I am encoding a number with that. What that means is I could take, you know, regular bits, I pick a three-digit number, or that's all I've got. I have that one number. For a quantum system, I could put it into a superposition of every possible number that those qubits can hold. So by performing some superposition magic and, you know, sprinkling a little physics dust on things, you end up with, you can have qubits have every number possible. And until you observe it, then you will collapse it down into just one of these numbers. So what that means is, if you can imagine doing computation with this, you can get great parallelization. If I add two bits on a classical computer, I get one answer out. If I add two qubits on a quantum computer that enter a superposition, I get all the numbers out. So what that means is with a quantum computer, you can do a whole bunch of different operations all at once, in essence. You're taking advantage of the superposition and the nature of physics to do everything all at once. Now, as you imagine, there are drawbacks. There are always drawbacks. So the big thing is you do all these parallel computations. So let's say I added, you know, all the digits from 0 to 3 together, and then I wanted to see the answer. So I go and I look, and I get one of these at random. And I don't know which one until I look. So I've made a computer that can add everything, and then when I look, I end up with one number again. And I don't know what number it is. So it's like doing all the math problems in the world and then pulling out an answer and saying, 313, I wonder if that's the answer I want. And that is the big drawback to quantum computers, that you get those random answers out, which means you've got to find a way to make them unrandom. Because a computer that does just random addition and random subtraction and things like that is, you know, we call that a toddler. You know, it, it's not much use to us. So a lot of smart people have worked very hard to come up with ways of getting around that. And there are ways around that. You essentially are modifying usually the quantum state so that whatever answer you pull out is the right answer, which is an awesome magician's trick. And the big one for this is Shor's algorithm. This is the one that is of great interest because of public key cryptography. So let's talk about it. Internet transactions, SSL, all those kinds of things, work on public-private key transactions. And the idea is you take two very big large primes. I suggest something bigger than 3 and, you know, 2. And you multiply them together, and you essentially use one piece as your public key that you hand out to everyone that they use to encrypt messages for you that can then only be decrypted because you know the private key. You can think of it as the two pieces. I hand out one piece, and you use that to encrypt, and then I get the thing back. And because I have both pieces of the key, I can unencrypt it. And the reason that that works is finding the factors of a very big number takes a very long time. It's one of those problems where if I know the two numbers, I can multiply and boom, I'm done. If I have one of the numbers and I have the the answer there, finding those numbers is very difficult, takes a long time. And it's always easier to go to bigger and bigger primes and make a longer and longer key, which takes more and more time to decrypt. So all the public-private key stuff depends on the fact that factorization is hard. And so what people are interested in is Shor's algorithm makes factorization easy. Step one, build a quantum computer. Step two, the world. So, here's some figures I'd forgotten about. So if you've got a 1024-bit number there, you're looking at, actually, give me about $50 million. There's a piece of equipment called T-Whirl that I could build that would let me get to it, in a year. If you go to 2048 bits, we're going to be around even longer. So that's what, a whole lot of internet banking, all that kind of stuff, depends on being able to do these kinds of encrypted transactions. And like I said, a quantum computer will factor easily. Genius, we're done, except you get the random answer out. So not so genius. So what you have to do is get a clever workaround. So let's do this. I'm going to get volunteers.
Who's willing to be a volunteer? Ah, I have them.
I'm untethered. If you two will come up. You two come up, and I need two women. Yes, you're picked. Any? Wonderful. Come and line up in front of me, my demonstrateers. Now I will arrange you. If you will step in between these two fine gentlemen. Notice anything about this line? There is a pattern. See if you can figure it out. This is a pattern.
Wait a minute.
He got it. Ladies and gentlemen, give him a hand. So this is a pattern that repeats every three people. So what I have here is a sequence with a period of 3. Thank you very much. I know. It was supposed to be a lot more exciting. But the reason that I needed to do that. Here, I guess I'll switch. I need one of those little telemarketer, like Britney Spears mics. So there are really good tricks to finding the period of something. If you have a pattern that repeats, we've got some good algorithms to do that. So in fact, you can turn finding the factors of a number into finding the period of a sequence. And in fact, that's generally how, even on a classical computer, that you you find the factors. There is some mathematical trickery that you can do, and you end up with the sequence. Then on the quantum computing side, you can do it so that every answer that you pull out is the period of the sequence. So I what I do is I factor it all, and instead of looking for a needle in a haystack, I end up looking for a haystack and, you know, needles in needles. I always get a needle out, which is not good for my fingers. So this is Euler's method of turning, if you've got the factors P and Q, so the two big prime numbers that I multiply together, pick a random number, that sequence has a period that evenly divides into P minus 1, Q minus 1. That's how we factor. And Shor's algorithm, sorry, there's my needles and needles. Shor's algorithm, that's Mr. Shor right there, will let you factor very quickly. So classical factoring, so let n be the essentially the size of the number that you're wanting to factor. And it goes, it's an exponential, it's a log exponential, but still. Exponential, so as the number gets bigger, it takes way more time to factor. That's not the case with Shor's algorithm. With Shor's algorithm, on a quantum computer, you can factor numbers very quickly. So if you had a decent-sized quantum computer with enough bits and could run Shor's algorithm, you could factor things very quickly. So that's why one of the things that got people really excited, and that's, you know, what has caught the attention of a lot of people for quantum computers is, well, if we could do that, we could factor prime numbers, and that, you know, doesn't sound really exciting, except then you can take down the whole, you know, financial infrastructure. So, can you do this with DOA 1? Can we bring down banking? And the answer is no. It is not going to happen, because DOA 1 was built to do different things. What I've described to you is what I'm going to call classical quantum computing with qubits where you're, you know, running algorithms on it. DOA 1 was designed to do something else, something called simulated annealing. Any simulated annealing fans? I was into them before they were big. So annealing is a way of solving very hard problems. One of the classical ones is a traveling salesman. So imagine, all right, so for you younger kids, we used to have these things called salesmen, and they would go from door to door and from city to city and sell things before the internet. So imagine that you've got your, you know, your salesperson, and you have a bunch of cities that you want to visit. It would be really nice if you've got, I guess this guy really has a good sales account. How do you find the shortest distance among all of those cities where you never repeat yourself? And that's one of those problems that if you tell me an answer, I can check really fast and see if it's true or not. But finding that takes a lot of time. And in fact, as you add more cities, it gets harder and harder and harder to solve these problems. So how do you do something like this? Well, you use simulated annealing in a lot of cases. So metal. If you heat up metal, then the atoms, you know, get more energy. And if you have stress in the metal, because, you know, as the metal was formed, you know, the atoms are not well lined up or anything like that, what you can do is heat up the metal, and those atoms sort of breathe and can move around and then settle back down where there aren't any stresses in the system. So what simulated annealing does is you have a problem and you say, all right, I'm going to give it what they call a cost function. So for the traveling salesman example, it would be, how far am I going around all of these cities? And then you do random jumps in the space. So let's say I've got, you know, 10 cities. Maybe I'll take city 1 and city 2 and reverse the order in which I go to them and see if that's better or worse. So, you know, here's the distance that I have to travel, and here's the configuration. So imagine, you know, I've got, I'll do this with three cities, because that's easy. So imagine, you know, I've got city 1, then city 2, then city 3. Then I have city 1, then city 3, then city 2. Then I have city 2, then city 1, then city 3, all through all the permutations. And each of those different permutations will have a different distance. So if I plotted the distance by the configurations, you know, it might look something like this. So I could have a case where I go to a local minimum. This one is lower over here than that one, but if I'm just slowly making changes, I might never see this. I might get down in here as, you know, I make a random change and I see if it's better. I make a random change, I see if it's better. I make a random change, I see if it's better. And eventually, I'm down here. So in simulated annealing, just like heating the atoms in the metal make them excited enough that they can move around and release the stresses in the system, what you do is let the random jumps be big enough that you are more likely to get out of these local minimums and go to the global minimum. So that's how simulated annealing works on computers. And we use those algorithms on computers now. It's a very common thing that, you know, airline bookings tend to use things like that, and evil. And the thing about quantum is, if this barrier is narrow enough, quantum mechanics say we can tunnel through things if the barrier is thin. So instead of having to make all these big jumps, you can actually tunnel through to towards another minimum and sort of keep tunneling until you are there. So quantum mechanically, you can do this faster than you can classically. And that is what D-Wave 1 has done. They have built a computer to do quantum simulated annealing. Now, here's the secret. Someone has the Space Corps. The secret is, we think this will speed things up. We don't actually know. Because there are all kinds of different algorithms or different problems that you can apply this kind of simulated annealing algorithms to, and they all have slightly different performances. And, well, you know, D-Wave has just now come out with the first computer to be doing all of this quantumly, and we don't yet know if it's going to make things faster. So there is no necessarily typical, performance time. We're just going to have to run in a lot of different problems and see how it behaves. So the question is, all right, not every person wants to deal with a traveling salesperson. Are there other problems that we can solve with these kinds of computers? And the basic one is binary classification. So imagine that I want to know, is there a car in this picture? So I train a thing on to recognize whether it's a car or not, and I can do that using simulated annealing techniques. And in fact, this is what Google did in combination with D-Wave a couple of years ago. They worked with D-Wave and did a binary classifier. They trained it on a bunch of cars and did trained it on a bunch of not cars, and it was able to say car, 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 no car, no car, car, car. Now, that sounds really exciting if you want to be able to tell that it's a car. But there are other more pertinent applications to it as well. So imagine that you've got a machine line and you're making parts, the parts are going through, and you need visual inspection, and you need to be able to tell if it is in true or not. You could do that with some binary classification. There are a lot of problems where you essentially want a yes or no answer out. You can also use this kind of simulated annealing technique to create neural networks. So neural networks are one of those things that when we were trying to figure out how the brain works, which we still don't know really, they're like, all right, maybe we can simulate how a brain works with a neural network. So the idea is you have all these inputs that you put in, and they get connected to these sort of hidden decision things, and then your answer comes out the other end. And there was a whole lot of work done on this for artificial intelligence. You know, can we make a machine that can learn? So the way that these are connected and what they call the weights, so the probability that you will go to one of these nodes, and often you'll have more and more nodes sort of stacked up that it will work its way through, how it works through that network, you have to train it. So you have to, you know, put the input in, and then the output comes out, and then you say, all right, that's the output we want, or it's not the output we want. This is the answer that we want. And so you have to train it up and set those weights and the connections. And you can do that with simulated annealing. And you can also do it with quantum simulated annealing. So the hope is with something like D-Wave 1, you could create these kinds of things faster for machine learning applications and things like that. Now, I've talked a lot about D-Wave 1. Let's actually look at what it looks like. That is the Rainier processor. That is the 128-qubit thing that gets put in a really nice bath of liquid nitrogen to cool it down. Because one of the things about quantum effects is it's easy for them to go away if they're disturbed by interacting with, you know, the universe. Light, any kind of vibrations, heat, because you've got these qubits in there. If you heat them up, then the quantum effects sort of smear out. So they have to isolate that. But on the front and back end, it's essentially computers. So they've got a regular computer that then passes stuff off to the Rainier processor that does the simulated annealing, and then it passes it right back out to a computer. And in fact, you can program this. They've got an API that will support Python, it supports Java, it supports C++. That's how you program this thing. So who wants one? That will be $10 million. Now, that's the starting price, because here's the thing. When you get the D-Wave 1, you don't just get the Rainier processor. You have to have the big isolated room, and you have to cool it down to cryogenic temperatures, and you've got to keep the liquid nitrogen flowing, and you've got to have the staff that keep it working. So we'll start with $10 million, and then you got to hire a bunch of people to sort of keep it going, which is why someone like Lockheed Martin, who just sit on a pile of cash, I guess, were like, sure, we'll take a quantum computer. Right now, D-Wave 1 is mainly being targeted to large companies that can afford that and have problems that if they could solve it faster with a quantum computer, it would make them money. They would save money and recoup the costs of getting D-Wave 1. This may be great. This may not be great. It's still in the early days. We're not sure. D-Wave 1 obviously is having to be careful because they're a commercial company. They don't want other people swooping in and grabbing their great ideas and making their own quantum computer. And Lockheed Martin is not talking about what they want to do with it either, which I'm sure is totally innocuous. In a lot of cases, the jury is still out. So to sum up, D-Wave 1 is not going to factor large numbers. It's just not going to do that. It's not built to do that. It's not designed to do that. Your money is still safe with eBay, as far as I know. They haven't crashed yet, right? But what it can do is, by simulated annealing, potentially make classification and decision-making for computers faster, which would be really nice, because there are a whole lot of things that if we could do simulated annealing faster, it would be really nice. They're up to 128 qubits so far, and that's after number of years of work. Hopefully they can continue to scale this up, but that's going to be a couple of years down the road. So the jury is still out. But that, for me, that's part of what makes that exciting, is this is still really brand new. It doesn't matter that, in fact, in all of quantum computing, we're still working really hard to try to put them together. D-Wave put a whole lot of money and a whole lot of time to put this thing together in the lab for, again, what I'll call a classical quantum computer. You've only got a handful of qubits that people have been able to string together for any length of time, 10, 12 qubits. They've run Shor's algorithm to factor the number 15. So that, I'm sure it went very fast. Well, that is why I am so interested in this subject and why I find it so fascinating, because it is in the very early days and it is where physics touches the real world and is potentially going to make some really cool things possible. And that is the end of my talk. There is a mic if anybody wants to ask questions. Raise your hand, unless I have so dazzled you with knowledge that there are no questions left.
Thank you. Given the probabilistic nature and the way that quantum computers can handle information, does that have the potential to break the information barrier that says no deterministic information greater than transitioning greater than the speed of light?
I won't say that it won't happen. It seems very unlikely to happen. I mean, people have looked at, can you essentially break the light speed barrier? And as far as we can tell, the answer is no. You can. I expect you will not be able to essentially backpropagate information. If that happens, that's going to be a fundamental rewriting of a whole lot of stuff that we know about physics.
Even though using a classical channel, you couldn't use that to. A quantum algorithm to, say, break down entanglement and break the probability from 50-50 to something else?
Now you're getting into the whole question of entanglement and quantum teleportation, which we still think you cannot propagate information faster than the speed of light. And that's a whole other talk and a whole deeper thing. So I at this point, I'm just sort of going to wave my hands and say, no, we don't think so.
So my question is actually also related to entanglement. As I understand it, quantum computing works because the qubits that they use are entangled together, and the difficulty in building higher and higher quantities of qubits is just the fact that they have to get all of them entangled together. Is the reason that we can get up to 128 with this system because they are not all entangled together? Is it?
That's an excellent question. The D-Wave 1 is actually in this sort of weird borderland because their system is actually hot enough that it's kind of doing quantum computation and kind of doing classical computation. It's actually in that sort of gray border transition zone, and they have to make it happen very fast because, of course, as they operate it, it heats right up. So they have just recently shown that they are getting actual quantum effects. There's been a big question for a while with D-Wave whether their computers were actually doing anything quantum, because, you know, how do you know? And so they've finally shown that, yes, they are getting some things that can only be explained by quantum effects, but it's fairly murky, and like I said, it's on that border zone. So that's part of why they can't do things like Shor's algorithm or Grover's algorithm or things like that. And so if you go to the sort of the classical qubit approach, where you're trying to have them really, you know, really cold and really isolated and really entangled, that's why it gets so hard, because you got to entangle them, and then you got to keep them there and not have anything happen before you turn around. So they've sort of fudged that, and that's how they've made that happen.
Is light the only transmission of information?
Do you mean, is light the way that these things are communicating? Is that the...
Is it the only way that it communicates? Could maybe magnetic waves or another system be used?
Right. Well, in fact, D-Wave 1 is using the magnetic spins of its qubits. So, you know, you're looking at spin flips of the atoms there. People have done it with light, although light actually turns out to be really hard. You can do it with electrons by spin, or by the fact of the Pauli exclusion principle, you can play some tricks like that. So... it really is any system that I can get two different states and can entangle them all together and then have them stay there.
So how large of a problem can 128 qubits solve?
I'm sorry?
How large of a problem? So like in terms of traveling salesmen or...
Well, you've got 128 bits of information. So that's your fundamental limit. I pass 128 bits worth of data in, I get 128 bits worth of data out. So, you know, not a lot. Any other questions? Going? Well, if not, thank you very much. I really appreciate you being here.